So much, Pastor Clay, and likewise, thankful for you, love you and your family and Dynamic Life family when we get together. It's a rich time whenever we can. The New Year's mark this year, we spent some time together here, and that was great, and we look forward to these holidays, and hopefully we can continue to do this more and more. And I appreciate about Dynamic Life, as I've said previously, and I'm mindful again even tonight and sitting around the table and chatting with some brothers. It's a church that is deep and wide. It's a church where Pastor Clay is a great preacher, taking people to the Word and growing in depth and discipleship. But it seems like whenever I'm around Dynamic Life, folks, I'm encouraged to be an evangelist. Seems like everyone I talk to is wanting to reach out, wanting to talk with people about Christ. And I think that's a mark of a healthy church, that what we've received, we want to give away. And that's natural, isn't it? We've received so much, and Easter reminds us of that, and we want to pass that on. Even newer believers I talk to at Dynamic Life, they want to talk to people about Christ. And that's encouraging to me. And we've done this together again for several years now. I've lost track, as I mentioned earlier, of how many times we've done something together, Maundy Thursday or Good Friday, Easter Sunday, I think one year we worked something out. I'm losing track now again, but I'm just grateful for all that we've been able to do together over the years and look forward to continued fellowship. When we have these kinds of times together and we lose track, we know each other, right? We're forgetting how many years we've been together, but we know what's going on in each other's lives more and more. We know where people work. We know kind of what their life situation is, and that's encouraging to me. I know there are a number of folks in the room who've been here, as I've mentioned, before then or at Dynamic Life on a Maundy Thursday. And I've preached, or Pastor Clay has preached, and so we are preaching pretty much the same text. Pastor Clay read it earlier, if you want to turn there, John chapter 13. This is familiar territory, and in fact, I have preached this passage here, and I think at Dynamic Life as well, over here, because Maundy Thursday is a day to remember this love command in John 13, 34, this command that Jesus gives. Maundy from Latin, mandate, kind of in English, this command idea. And so it's a traditional celebration. Some churches will actually do a foot washing kind of a thing. We instead eat. Work out the details. I'm going to choose eating. I don't mind your feet, but let's just sit down and look at each other face to face, enjoy some food. But we have this together, and so we have the same passage that we come back to traditionally, and I think it's helpful for us to be mindful of the significance of this idea. And it's pretty simple, isn't it? It's pretty simple to love one another. And yet, if you were to take the New Testament and just catalog the idea of love, choose your author, John, Luke, Matthew, Mark, obviously the Gospels are going to say some of these same ideas, but Paul, Peter, author Hebrews, James, this idea comes up over and over again. And Christianity, as complex as we make it sometimes, and it can be, the ideas of Christianity, its historical setting and language and culture and all the rest, it's fairly simple. God is love. He demonstrated that in the person of His Son in a radical way through death and resurrection, prefigured here in the foot washing. And he tells us to go and do the same. And Paul does this often. As you have received, so give. Hebrews, Peter, James, same kind of ideas. You've received love, go and live it. And the foot washing seems to prefigure this in an important way. So why the foot washing? Here we have an act that was common in the ancient world. This isn't the first foot washing in the New Testament, the chronology. In fact, we're here in John 13. If you flip back just to John 12. Yes. At this dinner, because of Lazarus' resurrection, Mary washes Jesus' feet with this ointment. She anoints his feet, wipes them with her hair. This kind of an anointing. This washing through an ointment, if you will. Luke chapter 7, another washing. And there's this picture there at the Pharisee's house where a woman washes Jesus' feet with her tears, wipes them with her hair. So this is a practice that was common. In fact, it's in that Luke 7 passage where it seems that Jesus is playing on this woman's act in light of what the Pharisee didn't do. He didn't show hospitality common in the ancient world. If you're having a guest over, you make sure that their feet could be cleaned as they came in, feet in sandals and dirty and all the rest. It was a common practice. But Jesus takes it here and makes it a symbol of what's to come. And we need to think not just about the symbol and what's happening, but where this is in the sequence of Jesus' life. Maybe an illustration would help. Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world right now. Have you heard of his name? He's the founder and CEO of Amazon. So if you've ordered something this week from Amazon, you've helped enrich Jeff Bezos in some way. And what an organization Amazon is. Right? Amazing. You can just about purchase anything on Amazon, have it shipped to your home. Incredible organization, and Bezos has founded this. And Bezos has just in the last year become the wealthiest man in the world. He is at the top of his game, if you will, in terms of business. Amazon is looked on as a model company. In the news a bit this week, and so there's pressure, what's Amazon's going to do and how they're going to react to different things. But Bezos is at the top of his game. He has surpassed Warren Buffett in terms of wealth, Bill Gates. He is the most wealthy man in the world. And his business doesn't seem like it's slowing down at all. He is at the top of his game. Imagine that if this week, Jeff Bezos, at the top of his game, the height of prominence, all his influence announced, that he's resigning. He's resigning the CEO position, and he's going to take up a job in the warehouse nearest the headquarters in Seattle. Wherever's nearest his office, whatever warehouse is nearest, he's going to set up shop there, and he wants the night shift. He wants graveyard, just putting boxes together, grunt work. The bottom rung of Amazon, he's leaving. That's what he wants. This act will symbolize all that Amazon is about. I'm going to leave the boardroom, leave the influence. I'm not concerned about the money. I want to demonstrate what Amazon is all about. It's all about service. It's all about making the customer happy. And I am going to find the graveyard shift and find the box putter togethers, and I'm going to join them in their work. That's my new role. This act would have repercussions for all of Amazon. What would the COO do? Managers, executives, they'd be looking around, what do I do now? He's the founder, chairman, richest man in the world, one of the most powerful men in the world, and now he's just a box guy. That's what Jesus did. If we think about the chronology of Jesus' life, he's at the top of his game, if you will. The resurrection of Lazarus in the sequence of John's gospel changes everything. It's at that point that Jesus' opponents are concerned about his influence because everyone is going to him. They call a meeting together and they say, we have to do something about this man because of his influence. And at the top of his game, Jesus humbles himself and takes up this position, if you will, in the analogy of the box guy in the graveyard shift. But it's here where the analogy breaks down. Because this foot washing in and of itself, because it's a washing, it's not just an act of service. It prefigures atonement, cleansing for sin. In the sequence of John 13 that we'll move through efficiently here, we recognize that Jesus is completely aware of what's happening. He knows what's going on. He is in control, and he humbles himself, and he takes up a common act, something that was necessary regularly done. But in his taking it up, in his initiative, his fulfillment of this action, the foot washing becomes altogether new because it cleanses, it shows cleansing in a unique way. And he's doing this and he knows what he's doing. And in the midst of Jesus knowing what he's doing, Peter doesn't really know. And Jesus teaches him along the way. But then, beyond just Peter, the 12 are there. Judas will go out by the end of the chapter. And so it's the 11 that Jesus is teaching about loving one another. So this act moves from sort of a vertical cleansing to a model of service that goes horizontal and loving one another. So we'll think about those ideas as we progress. Notice with me in chapter 13, read with me just verses 1 through 3, and I want to notice with you how John makes clear Jesus' knowledge of what's going on, his knowledge of the hour. His knowledge, if you will, to use the analogy again, that he's at the top of his game. He knows what's happening. This is a pinnacle moment. Chapter 13 and verse 1. Before the Passover festival, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Now, by the time of supper, the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas, Simon Iscariot's son, to betray him. And Jesus knew that the Father had given everything into his hands, that he had come from God, and that he was going back to God. If we were to take the first three verses of John 13 and sort of just lay them out phrase by phrase and quantify what those phrases do, we would see that the bulk of these verses is relating to the reader, to us, what Jesus knew. Notice the text again, just to draw it out. Verse 1, Jesus knew. And then if you go to verse 3, the first phrase, Jesus knew. And then we have these statements of what he knew. So the statement, Jesus knew. And whenever you hear that kind of knowledge, Jesus knew, or this person knew, or if we say it in the first person, I know, what are we sort of wanting to hear after that? What they know. I know what. There's always a content idea necessary after that. I know something. If you're talking with someone, maybe it's a coworker or maybe someone who works for you, and they say, I know, but you're not really sure that they know what they're supposed to do, you know what, right? Or your children. I know. Tell me what you know here, because I want to make sure you get this right. I know. Jesus knew, A, verse 1, the time. It was his hour. His hour had come to depart. Verse 3, two ideas. Jesus knew that the Father had given everything in his hands, and he knew, B, that he had come from God and was going back to God. He knew his mission had come to a point of climax. That's one way to synthesize this. He knew what was going on. He knew this was the moment of climax. And what does he do? He's sort of the CEO, if you will. Everything operating the way it should. And he leaves the boardroom. And he goes to the midnight shift. That's sort of what is happening here. When Jesus takes up the towel, it is a radical change of action for someone who's esteemed like him. This is a slave's job. This is what something that maybe a common person in the home would do, would wash people's feet or provide them something they could maybe wash their own feet. But general hospitality assumed that this was not an honored figure who would do this. Craig Keener writes, gestures of humility must have been common among the pious, but adopting postures of slavery must have been rare. For a person of status to wash his guest's feet as if a servant would be unthinkable! Exclamation point. That's what Jesus is. It's unthinkable for Jeff Bezos to leave his influence, his power, his money, and go to the midnight shift and put boxes together. And that's what Jesus does. It's altogether different. So, common task, a commoner. He gets up from supper, verse 4, lays aside the robe, takes up a towel, puts it around himself, pours water into a basin, began to wash his disciples' feet, and dry them with the towel tied around him. There must have been some awe in the moment. People like Jesus don't do this. People who raise folks from the dead, who exhibit such great power, this is not common. This explains Peter's reaction, verse 6. We go from the first few lines here of John 13, and it's clear that Jesus knows. He knows what's going on. He knows all the elements. He knows the big sequence of his life and the redemptive plan of God coming about right now at this time. And what we come to now is a contrast, what Peter doesn't know. I want you to observe here that Peter doesn't know the future, and he's not fully cognizant of all that Jesus has done in the past and what his relationship with Jesus is. The sequence of Jesus' interaction with Peter can be thought of in terms of knowledge and Jesus teaching Peter something about the future and helping him to understand what's already taken place. Notice with me in the text, verse 6, he came to Simon Peter, who asked him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus answered, "What I'm doing you don't understand now, but afterwards you will," verse 7, "afterwards you will know." You'll understand it. We have a contrast of knowledge. Jesus' knowledge, Peter's lack of knowledge. This is Peter's perspective, verse 8. "You'll never wash my feet, ever." He can't understand why Jesus would take up this lowly position. And he doesn't feel worthy. It just seems like this is on the surface exactly what's here. He doesn't feel worthy to have Jesus wash his feet. This is understood that this is a menial task and he's the Lord. As often as Peter is wrong and spurting things out, he is the most devoted up until the denials, which is part of the drama, right? Peter's the most devoted, so if he denies, what does that show? Everyone's dependent upon Jesus, even the most devoted. Peter's devotion, when it breaks, serves to underscore Jesus' sovereignty in bringing him along. Why? Because Jesus said he would deny. So what you have is Peter's boldness, but that is even seems carried along by Jesus. He's committed. And here, this is a reverential statement, I think, in verse 8. "You'll never wash my feet, ever." Again, Jesus is informing Peter about what's to come and the significance of this act in light of what is to come. Jesus replied, "If I don't wash you, you have no part with me." That's an interesting way to state the idea, isn't it? If I don't wash, you have no part. If I don't wash your feet, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. Why does Jesus use that kind of language, a part, participation? It calls to mind his kingdom, his reality that he is bringing in, and he's bringing them into his movement, into what he has begun and what will carry on. There is a sharing going on here, a partnership, if you will. And this act is a symbol of Jesus welcoming him in, prefiguring again the atonement that must take place, forgiveness of sin, for Peter to experience the fullness of the Spirit, the kingdom that's coming, and his full participation in it. This rock that Jesus would build the church upon. Peter being a figure in that sequence and in the perhaps the confession that Peter makes of Jesus as the Messiah, and nonetheless he's a figure who is a leader in this early movement. The early part of Acts is a demonstration of God's greatness through Peter, the Spirit through Peter. Peter's going to play a part in what happens. He has a part in it. We're going to think about that in a few moments further, but for now, Jesus teaching Peter about what's to come. Jesus has knowledge, all knowledge. Peter doesn't understand how this foot washing, this cleansing, is going to figure in his participation in the kingdom. Looking back, we can see how this all works. By being cleansed in Christ, we become partakers of him. And we could talk a lot about the inheritance ideas that might be involved here in participation and this kind of sharing that Israel enjoyed with God in the land that might be sort of in the mix here of the ideas of partnership and sharing and inheritance that might be going on here. It's an intimacy. It's a welcoming in. This happens by the Spirit, even after Jesus' resurrection. So Peter, in all his zeal, verse 9, if you didn't know what Peter said, but you knew the gospel record up to this point in Jesus' life, and someone gave you a little quiz, a multiple choice kind of a thing, A, B, C, D, and you had to choose what Peter's reaction would be, and this was on there, you'd likely choose what he says here, verse 9. Lord, not only my feet, but also my hands, my head, right? Over the top. This is Peter's devotion. This is his boldness. This is his courage. Again, he's going to fail. Jesus predicts it, and that's, again, a part of the drama here that demonstrates Jesus' sovereign power in carrying these disciples along. Nonetheless, this is Peter's personality and his human boldness. Not only my feet, but also my hands and my head. It's here where Peter's statement becomes a fulcrum for Jesus to teach Peter something about the past. He's already taught him about the future. I don't wash your feet, you have no part with me. That what I'm doing, this act, is prefiguring something more. And that more is going to involve you personally joining me in this. There's a participation that you will take up. You'll have a part with me in this. Organic, by the Spirit, as we read back into what John is writing here and Jesus has said. But here it's where Jesus turns Peter's attention to the past. One who's been bathed, verse 10, doesn't need to wash anything except his feet. But he is completely clean. Look at that. He is completely clean. It's here again where there isn't really a good analogy that works to help us understand how Jesus has taken up a common act and infused it theologically with what's to come. I've played around with this whole Jeff Bezos thing and leaving the office and going to the box room and taking the midnight shift, but that's not going to fix the main problem of all the workers at Amazon. It's not going to fix them on the inside. It would demonstrate humility, but it doesn't atone for their sin, nor does it help them to understand their status already. It's here where Jesus' statement about you're already clean does seem to hint at Jesus' cleansing word, his cleansing activity amongst the disciples. There's a sense in which we have to allow Jesus' statements here not to be pressed to their doctrinal conclusions fully, but just let them set there for a moment. Jesus' calling of these disciples, his teaching of them, has cleaned them in a sense. They're already cleansed because of their association with him, what he's shown them, what he will show them, his care for them. And this is where we recognize that there's something that's happened, and it's a cleansing, and it's real, and it's going to have effects, and it's going to keep these disciples so that they understand fully what will come because of what Jesus says about not everyone being cleansed. Do you see the next verse? Not all of you, the end of verse 10 and verse 11, for he knew who would betray him. This is why he said, you're not all clean. It's as if this cleansing that Jesus has in view is his word to them, his revelation to them. Their association with him has already given them a cleansingness, a wholeness, a grip together. There's washing to come. full reality of the atonement through his blood, but for now, Peter has learned. He's learned in the future there's a participation for him, and he's learned about the past, what Jesus has already called him to and where he's at. Jesus' knowledge, Peter's lack of, but he's learning. He's getting information along the way. And now Jesus unpacks this event for all. Verse 12. When Jesus had washed their feet and put on his robe, he reclined again and said to them. I've read verse 12 slowly for emphasis because it's superfluous. I don't mean that irreverently. I mean that just in a sequence of events. You could understand Jesus' statements to the 12 about the significance of this, even if John wasn't clear about Jesus finishing up in kind of a formal way the foot washing. This calls us back to the humility of Jesus here. When he had washed their feet and put on his robe, he reclined again. After he'd done the servant's task, he went back to his normal spot. And John is making it clear that Jesus is taking up this servant's position and he's wrapping it up. It's done. It's not just as if he continues on teaching. He's taken up a role to make a point, and that point's going to be clear now. Verse 12, in a true teacher's style, he asks a question. Do you know what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, this is well said, for I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you also should do just as I have done for you. I assure you, a slave is not greater than his master, a messenger is not greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. We'll stop there for a moment. Jesus' logic here seems to rest on the greater the lesser, and it's calling up again his position, and this is where that CEO imagery of Jeff Bezos works. Someone who is superior has taken up a task of someone who is inferior, far inferior. And slave is not greater than his master. One who sent is not greater than one who sent. In both of these analogies, what we have is the authority figure has let go of his authority and has moved himself down the ladder. And he has done so at the height of his game, at the point where he is most recognized. Again, Lazarus is the crowning miracle. Raising him from the dead sets in motion a sequence from Jesus' opponents that leads to the cross. This is the pinnacle of Jesus' power, and he lowers himself all the way down. Richest man in the world, not concerned about money, graveyard shift, putting boxes together. This is my glory. Jesus takes this common act and fuses two things into it. One, cleansing, atonement that will come. Two, a model of behavior for the disciples. This foot washing begins with a vertical idea, cleansing from God, and moves to a horizontal. And that's why it's a picture of the Christian life. It's what we've received and what we give out, how we receive love from God and forgiveness of sin, and we give love to one another. Not in the same atoning way, but in a way that shows love like Jesus loved. It's not atoning, but it's a reflection of the atonement. Craig Keener again writes, Jesus' act in this passage prefigures the passion. Laying aside, taking up, or not specifically sacrificial language, but a careful reader might recognize that the terms elsewhere appear together in John only in chapter 10, where Jesus says, I have the authority to lay down my life, I have the authority to take it up. By prefiguring his death in his act of service to his disciples, Jesus indicates the cost he is ready to pay to save them. By washing one another's feet, disciples would prefigure their service and love for one another after Jesus' model. That is, they would declare their readiness to die for one another. It's not just love if we recognize that the foot washing prefigures Jesus' passion and death, and he goes and tells the disciples to spread out love likewise. We have to conclude logically that Jesus is getting at, be ready to give your all for one another. And there's a purpose to all of this. Pastor Clay read it earlier, verse 31. This is after Judas has gone out. We've already referenced Peter's denials that Jesus is going to predict. Those are at the end of the chapter. But in the midst of that, Jesus gives a command. A command about love. In the midst of Judas going out and Peter thinking himself strong, not carried along by the Lord, Jesus gives this command to love one another. It's triggered by Judas going out. Verse 31, when Judas had gone out, Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and will glorify him at once. Children, I'm with you a little while longer. You'll look for me, just as I told the Jews, where I'm going, you cannot come. So now I tell you, and I give you a new command, verse 34, to love one another. Verse 34, this command, this commandment, this is the idea of remembering this command. That's Monday, Thursday, remembering this command. The command to love one another, to continue on in loving one another. Leon Morris writes, love itself is not a new commandment. It's an old one. Think of Leviticus 19:18. And there are lots of ideas about love in the Old Testament. The new thing appears to be the mutual affection that Christians have for one another on account of Christ's great love for them. A community has been created on the basis of Jesus' work for us. And there's a new relationship within that community. What makes this command new is that love is now defined by Jesus' self-sacrificing love. It's a deeper, more profound love. It's a love that requires us to go all the way. I mean, how much more could you love someone than you would die for? Right? And that's the command. Love one another the way I love you. I'm giving my life for you. Be ready to give your life. Be ready to give your life. And Jesus said that what would be the result of this kind of love? Verse 35. This is how you'll be known. This is how you'll be known to me, my disciples. Larry Hurtado, in his new book, Destroyer of the Gods, notes that in the first couple of centuries of Christianity, what made Christianity grow so robustly, so quickly, was its ethic. Its endurance of martyrdom, its ethic of community support and care for one another, its persuasive ability through how its members lived. It's really true. Jesus said it, and we can see it historically chronicled. Christians were known for their love for one another, their willingness to share, to help, and to be committed to Jesus despite what would come. Why the foot washing? It's not just a symbol of humility. I've tried to share how, again, Jeff Bezos would, this little analogy would show humility. That would work. But the foot washing is not just about humility. It's about atonement for sin. It's prefiguring that. It's a kind of cleansing that only Jesus could do. But within that, there's an example for us because Jesus atoned for our sin by his death. That's his love. So to love one another would be willing to give our all for one another. That's the way it works. I want to set out just a few ideas as we wrap up, and hopefully these can be ideas we continue to walk in. I don't know about you, but if your situation is like mine, it's a good thing that you hear this yearly, and you need to be reminded of it often. Both of the atoning work of Jesus, but the call to love others and to love in such a radical way. To be willing to die for someone. To be willing to lay down our lives, not just for the gospel in a hero martyr sort of mindset that we can get into that's not necessarily bad. And we trust God's going to carry us along in those moments. Do I love the people of God enough that I'd be willing to die for them? For them. I want to set out just four categories here of love. Maybe we could think of these as steps on the way to being willing to die, to give ourselves, to try to give it all. And I want you to think about these on a continuum. So I'm going to set out four steps, and if you could think of extremes, one on the left, one on the right. And all of us are likely somewhere in the middle. With all four of these ideas, there's a sense in which there's a lesser end and a greater end. The lesser end, we'd want to progress from that. We want to go toward the greater end with each of these. But we start with the first one. And you being here, I want you to recognize, is an act of love. It's a legitimate act of love. I think Christians sometimes get down on themselves because, especially if you're not someone who's up front, you're not someone who's recognized as contributing in some way to the church in some upfront kind of a way. But you're there, you're trying to help other people, but it's pretty much your participation is just you show up at meetings of some kind, a small group or a church or whatever. I want you to recognize that that is an act of love. I want you to see it that way. I hope you do. You may not. It's easy for you to get down on yourself. I don't think that's real. You being here tonight, do you recognize that your participation here tonight encourages those around you? Do you have that perspective? That's partnership. That's participation. You being here, I want you to know, I don't know everyone's name here. I've tried to learn some names even tonight, met some people. But I want you to know, you show me love by being here. You show love to the people around you. You may not even know the people sitting around you. But you, by being here, you are showing them love. And I want you to think about that step as a legitimate step of following this command. To participate, to be here, to be consistent, to recognize that attendance matters. And it matters if you're on time, that you can be here so we can join together, maybe early. It matters that when you're here, you're awake. You know, I know it's a Thursday night, it's a little later. We did have some Coke in there, so hopefully it helped, some coffee too. But no, you're there and you're participating, that this matters to you. That you could even in this category of attendance and participation, just in terms of attending, we could all move from the lesser to the greater. When we gather, we could have a mindset that because of Christ and Christ in me via the Spirit and in the church community, when we gather, simply our showing up in the Spirit, ready, prepared, and recognizing God's presence among us, this will bless one another. This is love. This is love. This is a community connection. It matters. It's true, I think, at Dynamic Life, for you to participate, to show up, to be ready, to be invigorated, to prepare, to read beforehand if it's a sermon, if it's a project you're working on, to be prepared for that, to engage it, to be there consistently. Attendance. We could all do more. I'm not saying you have to be at every meeting of your church. Not every meeting is likely for you. But those that are, see it as an act of love. It's hard to imagine that you'd be willing to die for people if you're not willing to show up and sit by them. It's hard to imagine you'd be willing to die for people if you're not ready to just sit down and enjoy their fellowship, or if you're consistently late. How does that show love? How does that show I'm willing to die for you? Second, prayer. Step one would be attendance. The second step, prayer. At our church, and I don't know about Dynamic Life, but I know you pray. I know there are prayer meetings. I assume there are vehicles and mechanisms to let folks know about what to pray for. But do you recognize here that if we're commanded to be ready to die for one another, it seems to make sense that we pray for one another?
Yes.
I mean, it just seems that that wouldn't be too much to ask. That if there's a request listed on a church bulletin or a website or a social media, that we would take it seriously. And that we would see ourselves on this spectrum of lesser to greater and be moving toward greater. To have a heartfelt concern for people that leads me to really pray for them. I'm so encouraged what I see in our church, and I trust it's in Dynamic Life as well. People, hey, pray for me about this, pray for me about this, and be ready to pray and encourage and keep up with one another in things. You know, one of the blessings of hard times for all of us is it gives us an opportunity to love one another in prayer. Because some of the hard stuff God allows into your life is simply to help others love you by praying for you. If you'll make it known. It's just love. I love you. I care about you. This hurts me. This burdens me. This consumes me. This is worth my time. This is worth me stepping away from entertainment for a moment, stepping away from an extra project at home for a few moments, to pray, to grab other people, to intercede. Because we are partnering in something. See this? I trust we'll all move from lesser to greater. Third, service. We begin with attendance. I'm thinking about prayer and the third step, service, along this way to maybe dying for one another. Again, I'm encouraged when I hear about Dynamic Life and people serving one another. When I see some of you here, I see the way you serve one another, and it encourages me every time. I'm not around you that much, but it can't be fake, because I see it every time we're together, or somebody's acting really well. I don't think that's the case. And I see it in our church. When there's a need, people step up, and we have to continue to think that way and use whatever we have in terms of abilities or strength to serve one another. That does mean in church capacities, in our functions together, and outside. And again, we are all on a spectrum. I'm not trying to guilt anyone here. I could guilt myself. That's not it. We're somewhere between nothing and fulfillment, right? We're all on that spectrum somewhere. Let's just move further along to serving one another, to seeing needs and meeting them, to think about other people. When we are around, when we're attending, when we're praying, I think it's a natural progression. A, I see other people, and I love them. I want to be around them. B, yes, they have needs. I'll take those needs to God. C, I'll do something about it too. You see how that works? I don't think that's illogical. Do something to help other people, to see needs, to ask. One of some young people in our church, this is becoming contagious. I see them and I'm around here. They ask sometimes, is there anything I can do for you? Do you know what that is? What if every evangelical had the attitude of seeing others, praying for them, and then asking, what could I do for you? What could I do for you? Is there anything you need a hand with? What could I do to help you? It's so easy to complain, to be thinking, I wish this were better, that were better. Let's turn our energy away from how we think the world should be and look at each other's needs and put our intensity here. What can I do for you? Because we're participants. there is really a sense in which we are God's hands and feet. Now, don't press that beyond, but it is a sense in which God works through us. Your service to people around you is God working through you. This is the foot washing. This matters. If you're willing to die for someone, that's the command. Be willing to die for someone. I don't think it's a stretch if you see a need to go and try to address it. Let's continue on in this. Attendance, prayer, service, last, giving. And again, we could be on a spectrum with all of these. If you're here, obviously you're not off that end, but we all could progress, and myself included, but giving. I bring this up because we may be at the wealthiest moment in history. When you look at the present state of the United States economy, and I'm not an economist, but I do try to follow some trends, and where the stock market is at, where wages are at, where they seem to be headed generally in the last few years, and price indexes, or indices, I should say, fuel has been in the news just recently because gas prices are starting to go up a little bit. But they've been down for years while wages and the stock market have gone up. Most of us have more disposable income than we've had in years. And all of this, remember, follows right out of the Great Recession, 2007 to 2012. Major losses of worth. Now that's all picking right back up. If you have any kind of investment income, you have made a ton of money in the last couple of years. Maybe some of that could be used for kingdom purposes. Maybe some of our square footage, maybe some of our horsepower, maybe some of what we have could be given to people who need it. People in Kansas City, people around the world, true believers who might be in need, believers who are trying to reach out and witness to other people. There are probably large amounts of money that evangelicals could give. It's just sitting there, waiting for some purpose. You know, the economy could tank soon, and you'd lose all that money. So start giving some of it. It could be used to help people in lots of ways. Some of what we have, we haven't touched. We have recreational vehicles we see once a year. Toys that just, square footage that's not used. I just think if we're commanded to die for someone, it wouldn't be a stretch to give more if we can. Does that make sense? To give with a generous full heart. Toward the kingdom, toward kingdom needs, to people, even to non-believers, try to reach them, to love, to reach out. Would you pray with me? Lord, we're mindful tonight of the atoning sacrifice that you have made and that you have washed us clean, the participation that we enjoy, and we pray that you will help us to participate fully in these ideas and others. What a thought that you would give your life for us. And so we ask for grace to take it seriously that we should give our lives for each other. Help us be willing, God. Help us to understand your grace to do that. Thank you for our time here tonight. It's been sweet and special. I pray that you'll bless Dynamic Life in every way in this and our church as well. We ask in your son's name.